timer or recorder? Oh, okay.
My name is Doug. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Doug.
Is there a time limit? 20 minutes. God, that's important. I don't know about you guys, but I get behind a podium and I start feeling so full of myself that I can just go on and on and on. And I know Danny knows what I'm talking about. And so, so we get to talk about the big book, and the big book comes alive. And I hope that you guys understand that I'm not any kind of authority. I don't have any kind of degree in big book stuff. I'm just a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with a little bit of passion for the big book. I may not get everything right. I brought Danny along as a fact checker. If you see his hand shoot up in the back of the room, or if he starts dancing around, spinning in circles, or looking like the exorcist back there, you know I got something wrong. I got sober in San Diego. My sobriety date is November 22nd of 1991. And if I was 19 years old, it was 6 days before my 20th birthday, but I hold on to that. I was 19 years old when I got sober. And I got involved with a group of Alcoholics Anonymous relatively quickly. I got myself a sponsor relatively quickly. And the first thing that he had me do as we sat down and we started working together was he had me read out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Initially, my first sponsor when he got sober was illiterate, and he couldn't read the big book. So his sponsor would read to him, and he started off reading the big book to me, and I'm full enough of myself and kind of an arrogant ass most of the time, that one of the first things I said to him was, you understand I know how to read, right? And he said, that's great. You know, why don't you read to me? And so I did. And I didn't ask a lot of questions when I was new. Kind of just did what was told of me. If I thought it fit with my agenda, I did the stuff that I thought applied, and I kind of ignored the rest. And I made a lot of assumptions, and I got a lot of facts incorrect. As I continued to stay sober, and as I stayed a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and as I attended meetings, I heard lots of stories inside the rooms of AA that really made an impact on me. One of those was the story of Ebby, and how he had quote-unquote died drunk. And that was a story that I heard a lot when I first got sober. And another experience that I had was at the 1995 International Conference in San Diego. I was walking through the tents of drunk junk, you know, outside the conference, and there was a reprint of the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was with my sponsor at the time, and he was looking through it, and it didn't look like the current book that we had. And he said, boy, they got this all wrong. Look at how they capitalized these words and the page numbers are incorrect and yada, yada, yada. And what I came to discover was is that there were a lot of well-intentioned, uninformed people in Alcoholics Anonymous that propagated a lot of myth just because they heard those stories repeated in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so if anything that I can say today, in studying especially this first portion of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you hear stories about it, make sure you ask about it. You know, don't assume that because I'm 18 years sober and standing up here in a suit and have a little bit of a passion for the book of Alcoholics Anonymous that everything that I say is golden. So with that, as I started to do some study, what I discovered was is that, Ebby died sober. He died sober with 18 months of sobriety. I had an opportunity to meet his last sponsor, a gentleman by the name of Sir C.W., who went to the White House group out in Texas, and I'm going to say it's, I want to say it's Dallas, but I may be wrong. So, check that. The next time I saw a first edition Big Book, what I saw was is that those capitalizations in the beginning of the book were what we italicize now, but that was actually the way that they printed it. And because I'm a horrible speaker, I brought a bunch of props, and you guys are welcome to look through them at the end of the... this is a ninth edition of the... Ninth printing of the first edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The desk, or the dust jacket itself, is a reprint. The old dust jackets were mixed. The paper was kind of poorly constructed, and they tended to crack and break a lot. So to find one with a real desk jacket intact is kind of... well, it's kind of rare. So the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous is laid out a little bit different than our book today. The first 164 pages were actually the first 179. The doctor's opinion starts on page 1. There is a foreword. There is, if you can see... precisely how we recovered is all in capital letters, and you can come up and look at it after the meeting. Bill's story starts on page 10. The vision for you ends up on page 179. The book has only got two appendices, and the sizes of the book varied quite a bit over the course of the Big Book itself, the first edition itself. And there's lots of quirky things that I could spend probably all day boring you to death with about it. Nonetheless, the big red book that you see commonly referred to as the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous is really the first edition, first printing of Alcoholics Anonymous. This, the first edition itself came in 16 printings from 1939. Until 16 printings from 1939 to 1955. The second edition was introduced in 1955, and it looks like this. This book is laid out pretty much the same way the fourth edition is. The story sections have been divided up into three different sections. The book itself is a little bit longer. The first 164 pages is actually the first 164 pages. And I'll leave that up there. And then the last two, the third edition, started in 76 and went until 2000. And then the fourth edition that we're currently on started in 2000, and they're still printing copies of the fourth edition, and this just happens to have a cover on it. So with that, the prefaces in every single book after the first edition changes. The preface is kind of an introduction to this book, and then there's a foreword that's carried over from book to book to book. So the fourth edition has got a foreword to the first, a forward to the second, and a forward to the third. The details kind of just give you a growth and an idea about what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And then it gets into the doctor's opinion and then gets into Bill's story. I'm sorry, I feel out of sorts today. I got to live in Japan for a year while I was sober, and I went to meetings over there with a guy named Fuji, and Alcoholics Anonymous at that time had been in Japan for about 30 years, and their nationwide membership was about 6,000 people. And when you look at the beginning of our history from Alcoholics Anonymous, the start of the first book when it was first printed in 1939, going to the second book in 1941, you had this mushrooming effect of the growth of our fellowship. And over the course of 1 year, from, I'm going to say it's 41 to 42, and I may be wrong, but after the Jack Alexander article came out in the Saturday Evening Post, our membership tripled. And Fuji, when he talked about Alcoholics Anonymous and the idea that we were able to have a God that was personal to us, that it didn't have to be ordained by an established religion, his opinion, and this is something that I carry with me, but his opinion was that only in America, where we had enough freedom to believe, we had the freedom to say that something like that was okay, would be a place where Alcoholics Anonymous could get a foothold and start. Like it, in his opinion, it couldn't have started in Japan because their society was so narrow and so rigid in their established beliefs, and we didn't have that here. You know, that we had the ability to think outside of the box, quote unquote, in that area. And as you look at the different things as they happen over the course of our history, you just watch this fellowship explode in the numbers. Those details are laid out in the different forewords, the stories on how our traditions came to be, about how the how our fellowship has grown to accommodate the different members, the different varying stories, the different walks of life that that are represented in Alcoholics Anonymous are touched on in that area. If you look at the doctor's opinion in the beginning of the book, one of the things that you'll see in the first edition is that the doctor's opinion is not signed. Second, third, and fourth, you'll see very truly yours, William D. Silkworth, M.D. And this may be an opinion, but what I've read in my studying is that they did not include Dr. Silkworth's name in the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous, simply because there was the concern that if Alcoholics Anonymous didn't take off, that if his opinion proved to be wrong, it might negatively impact him, and they didn't want to do that. So it just says very truly yours ... at the end of the doctor's opinion, after Dr. Silkworth passed, and the second edition came out, his name was added to that for posterity. And I guess really quickly on Bill's story. Bill was born in a little town in Virginia. His date of birth was November 26, 1895. Vermont. My apologies. He was born in a little town in Vermont, not Virginia. My apologies for being nervous. And his story at the beginning of the book kind of... it's a good overview of his life up to the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous. You can find lots of other stuff to read about Bill. Some of it maybe not so good, some of it exceedingly good. Nonetheless, Bill's story, I think, in the big book is where we start, or we are definitely introduced to the idea of unmanageability. You know, what that really looks like for an alcoholic. It may not be exactly like your story, and it's certainly not exactly like my story. There are certain things in here that I particularly enjoy. I really enjoy that the Northeastern humor, and in the sense that let's see if I can find it. So it says liquor on page 5. It says liquor ceased to be a luxury, became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3 got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s, and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens. This went on endlessly. I began to awaken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler of gin followed by a half dozen bottles of beer would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Gradually, things got worse. And that kind of a description, although not impossible today, seems kind of uncommon. You know, most people hit a bottom before bathtub gin and 2 bottles a day in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the way that he kind of understated the whole gradually things got worse is something, or that kind of humor, I particularly enjoy. Okay. I guess because I'm so disjointed, I'm going to wrap it up here pretty quick. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, is written down as a direction, as an instruction manual. I think we go through from the beginning through the end of the 12 steps and do the stuff in order as they're laid out. I think that I'm really looking forward to the rest of the presenters. I'm really grateful to get to be here and to participate on this panel. I don't know what else to say. Thank you. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, without a doubt, saved my life, and I feel sometimes ill-equipped to describe the passion that I have for the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope that you guys have a chance to take a look at the books. I don't think it's required for anybody to have a copy of each one of the early editions of the Big Book. Collecting early editions of the Big Book doesn't make you any more sober than anybody else. It might make you a little more poor than other people because tracking them down and buying them are pretty expensive. I think that I'm blessed to be a member of AA, and if I have a chance to sit down and talk to you about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and show you some of our old literature, and I'm grateful to be here and to participate. So thanks for letting me share.
All right, thanks, Doug. Our next presenter is from Tucson. He will be sharing on Chapter 2, 3, and 4. Please help me welcome John.
Are you the timer?
20 minutes.
All right. Okay, happy Halloween. I see some of you are still wearing your same mask as from last year. I'm John. I'm a recovered alcoholic, as described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I am clear that I'm not cured of alcoholism. I'm clear of that. This is not my favorite thing. And those that know me, that I don't like groups, and I don't like doing this sort of thing. I love the one-on-one, and I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, if it had a gizmo, I'd take it to bed. In fact, if you can't sleep, you might want to read it, because it will put you to sleep. It did for me at the beginning. To cover 2, 3, and 4 in 20 minutes, which takes hours to do with somebody on a one-on-one, it's kind of difficult. And I was thinking about it, and I thought, well, okay, God, what are we going to do? I have a God that's more powerful than me. So hopefully this is going to come out the way it's supposed to. Now, I'm a believer that nobody should read your Big Book for you, because it seems to change. And when I work with my guys, I ask them, what's it mean to you? And it's the same thing as when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I seen the God stuff. I thought, what the hell did I get myself into? Some sort of a cult or religion here. But I am what the book says, and my favorite chapter at the time when I came in was agnostic. And Bill W. was agnostic. That means I didn't even know what that word meant, agnostic. I had to look it up. It means one that does not deny the existence of God, believes there's no proof of a supreme being, sometimes confused with atheists. I thought maybe that was where I was at. But I broke it down a little simpler. A-G, if you spell it, without. Gnostic, N-O-S-T-I-C. I was without knowledge of a power greater than myself. And that the alcohol and drugs had ruled my life. And I thought I was the center of the world. So this chapter was important to me, and I don't know how far we're going to go with it. But I remember when I was in detox and I seen that stuff on the wall, and the God stuff, and I thought cult, religion, something like that. And I did not know. I believe if you're willing to do this deal, the right people will cross your path. And they did at the time, even in detox, and they said, do you know the difference between organized religion and spirituality? I thought it was the same. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program. I needed to find my spirit, which was comes from within. Bill, in his story also, when Abby brought him the solution, Bill thought religion. And then Abby says, why don't you have your own concept of a power greater than yourself? And that turned the thing around for him. It was the same thing when I came in. Why don't I have my own concept of a thing? The book, I'm going to bring this up, and the guy in the room just recently, this last year, had said something, and I liked it, and I use it. God is only a nickname to me. I had a power, and it's God to me is something I can't even define. And in the second step there, it says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves restores to sanity. It does not say came to believe in. And when my sponsor was asking me things in there, and you're asked certain things in that book. I'm going to get to that. But first off, when I got to the agnostic chapter, it says that only a spiritual experience can conquer my disease. That willpower, control, and self-knowledge is going to avail you nothing. Nothing. Well, when you're new, you think you don't think like that. You just don't. But I needed to seek out something greater than myself that's going to take care of my disease. The book, and in this chapter, and I don't have much time on this, so you have to bear with me. It says, first of all, lack of power was my dilemma. Okay, I can admit that, kind of. I can admit. See, the first step, it's hard to talk about a step when you can't, you got to bring in these other steps. You can't just talk about one, the others come in. It spends 43 pages on just the first step to convince me, first off, that I'm an alcoholic and addict and my life's unmanaged. It's pretty obvious to most of us if you dig deep in it. But the second step, and there's a part in there that says, we found as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe that a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it's impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. You know, I don't even know what's coming out. I'm just going with the flow here. I asked my God. He's doing the deal here. I have to admit it. I think I know what I'm saying. But it's coming out through what I've learned in my experience. When it said lay aside prejudice, now if you haven't done this deal and you have a good sponsor, he'll probably bring it up to you like mine did. He asked me not to have prejudice, but just can I lay it aside and believe that there's some sort of another creative intelligence, spirit of the universe, something like that. I heard a tape, in fact, somebody gave me a tape just recently about Mark Houston, just his last tape before he died, that the earth is a spirit in itself in things. And I used to take my acid and I'm from the 60s when I think the drugs are really good. And maybe I was on a quest, I don't know. But I needed to find my spirit. And where was that? And the book's asking me, just lay aside prejudice, just have an open mind that there's a possibility of a creative intelligence. Just a possibility that there's something greater than myself. Now this book, this textbook, I believe it's very important if you want recovery. And you need to find someone who has working knowledge of this book, especially in the second step. So it says, came to believe. And the sponsor is going to ask you this. Ask ourselves one short question. Do I now believe or am I willing to believe? When I was new, I had a problem with this God stuff. I thought I had a problem. I was the problem, of course. And I've worked with a lot of guys, and there's only a few that said, because most of them want to tell me what they want me to hear, I believe, sometimes too, that they believe. But I told my sponsor I was willing to believe. See, it says in the second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves restores to sanity. It does not say came to believe in. When I was new, I was not able to believe. But I was willing to believe. And what the 12 steps gave me was an opportunity for me to have my own experience with this power greater than myself. And the 12th step, having a spiritual awakening as a result of this, all it means is my spirit's come alive. I have a conscience today. I'm alive. I'm part of. I know things today like I've never known before. I have to move along on this, don't I? Because this is 2 and 3. Okay, so to get through the second step is how I told my sponsor I was willing to believe. It says, as soon as a man can say that he believes or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon a simple cornerstone, a wonderful, effective spiritual experience can be built. To find my spirit was through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the 4th and 5th step, and I ain't there yet. But what I want to get at more than anything is I always like to tell my little fish story. And it's this like these three fishes swimming in the ocean, and this old wise fish come by. He says to the little fish, isn't the water fine today? As he swims on by, and the three little fish look at each other and say, water? What's water? And they swim all around the ocean looking for water. Well, that was me looking for my spirit. Was I looking for the wet and water all my life through drugs and booze or trying to be what I wasn't? See, all my life I was whatever, trying to be what other people wanted me to be. I was never myself. In Bill's story too, it was important I think too, because he was agnostic like me. It says he humbly, in Bill's story I think it's 16 or something, he humbly offered himself to God as he then understood him. Now I looked up that word then. It means a point of time. So whatever you got, you're thinking of as a power greater than yourself right now is a then, and it will change. That's just the way it is. It will change for you. I always believe too, give as much of yourself as you know to as much of God as you understand. That helped me. Another thing that somebody said too, why don't you, if you want to know your God, why don't you spend more time with Him? And that's even when I take, when I go to the bathroom and take a, I thank my God that things are working. That's how close I am with this power today, and how grateful of finding something that is more powerful than me, that took me away from my obsession of booze and drugs. The third step, okay, I got through the second step. And I thought, okay, now I got to make a decision to turn my life and will over to the care of God. Now, behind every one of these steps, there's a principle. By this time, the principle behind the second step is hope. I'm having some hope in this deal, and for the first time in my life, I'm sober. Which is neat for me anyway, I thought, because I was starting to feel things. It was uncomfortable at times, but I was feeling. This third step is faith. But what is faith but possibilities? And I was around AA long enough to realize that, wow, I'm part of something. And most of all, I started to believe in something. And so AA had started giving me things. But I get to my third step, And there's a lot in this third step stuff. First off, it reads how it works. Now, I know how it works today. Some people in the room say, oh, I don't know how it works. It just works. To me, I know how it works. Every time I had done a step, there was a change in me. It was for the better, and it lasted. Okay, that's pretty simple, isn't it? And that's how it seemed to work for me. But my thing, having still a problem with this God concept, and in the Gnostic chapter, it's stressed very strongly, it has to be your own concept. I can't have mine, I can't have Jeff's. It's a very personal deal. And you grow in this personal deal. Even though we have the fellowship, and the most interesting meetings I go to are spiritual meetings. And people try to explain their spirituality. I can't define my spirituality. It just, my spirit's alive today. I have a conscience. And it's neat to have. The thing is, how could I turn my life and will over to this unknown entity when I was the one living my life? And I would hear people say in the meetings, oh, just turn it over. Just turn it over. And I'm thinking, well, how do you turn it over? You know, I'm new. Again, the right person come along. John 4 through 9 will show you how to do this. Thank you. I can move on. So I'm going to make a decision. But before that, I have to be convinced of three things. A, that I was alcoholic and could not manage my own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve me of my alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if He was sought. Now, I didn't find Him. You're going to seek Him. Important word in the 11th step is sought through prayer and meditation. I never was good at that either. Thanks to the program and people, I learned how to do it a very personal way. But if I wasn't, it says right after that, being convinced. If you're not convinced of those things, I don't believe you can move on. I don't believe you do your first step, you can't do the rest of the steps. So how do you do this? But it's a process of a thing. Before the third step, though, they give you an idea of looking at yourself, how you're selfish and self-centered. We don't really look. Where in your life did you ever look at yourself? You always wanted your own way. You're going to be kind, considerate to get it, or you're going to be the other way around to get it. You were going to get your way, and that's what I was able to see. I had to stand on that position, that requirement, in order to move on to the third step. That I was now ready to turn my life and will over to an unknown entity? I see going to be the father, the director. Am I going to, you know, I'm just his agent. And when I said okay, even though I was meaning it? I don't know. It's like in the sixth step, it says, are you ready now? How do you know you're ready? There's a process here of coming to the meetings, working with people, having fun about it. If you ain't going to have fun in your sobriety, I don't think it's going to work. But the thing is, we're not a glum lot. Just think of your last days of using and drinking, how glum you were. This is a little bit better than that, I would think. It was for me, anyway. So anyway, I have to be convinced of that. And having a concept, it says, I could build a new arch. Concept means an image of something. There's a part also, I believe, all questions can be answered, but you got to look within. Back on the second step, too, on page 55, it says everything has to come from within. Within. How do you get there? How can you find the spirit from within? So a decision to turn my life and will over, it wasn't that I did anything, it's just a decision. Like I'm going to go to this conference when I signed up for it, but until I actually showed up here, nothing was done. So there has to be action behind this. And here's where I thought my sponsor, we did the third step, and I like this third step, but I'm not going to go through because my time is running out. 5 minutes. I'm not doing too bad, I don't think. He works. He's a gizmo. Anyway, I can't go through the third step. That's kind of neat, huh? Because it says it's optional, so whatever you want to do it. But it has some very good points in there. The whole big book has a lot of good points. If you're open-minded enough, you'll get it. Okay, I thought my sponsor tricked me. I did the third step. He gets on his knees. I did it on my knees. He tells me we're going to do it on the knees. Do it. I don't get on my knees today. That's not part of my deal. I don't say the Lord's Prayer because I'm not a Christian. See, I have my own concept, an image of my God. and it was developing through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to find myself like never before. In a way, I started doing it, I thought he tricked me. And here's just going to really add it. It says the third step would have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a course of vigorous action. I needed to start looking at myself. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous to me is a little bit religion, psychiatry, social and medicine. And now I'm going into the psychiatry part. I went to a shrink once. Years is a long time when I was a kid. I didn't tell him the truth either. How am I going to tell the sponsor? Anyway, he got me on the columns. And 3 minutes here probably. Okay. I work with the guys I've developed. I did it as honest as I could the first time around. It was my first experience with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did the columns. I'm going to say something real simple for those that have resentments. How to master them, because it tells us we have to master them. I think this is important. If you want to master a resentment against somebody, look at them and think, well, I'm not mad at them. I'm mad at their actions. It kind of lessens it. So I use that one an awful lot to my life, and I hardly have any resentments about anybody. But I'm doing through the columns. First off, I find the resentment, and how did it, what was the cause, effect, and then I got to look at my part. And it asks me many times, you look at the fourth column, it says disregard that person. So when I work with guys, I have them disregard whoever they're resentment at, because they probably got the same thing or could have the same thing with other things. And I'm about
2 minutes.
2 minutes, all right. We can move on to the fear inventory. It's like fear is like expectations of evil. I had to look at a lot of fear things. But the fear thing we looked at in that first column is fear-driven selfishness. That's the fear we looked there. Then we have a fear inventory. And I'm not going to get in that. But here's a part of the inventory process. I don't know why we don't spend more time in the rooms about is sex. Why don't we spend more time in the rooms about sex? Because we have to do an inventory on it. And there's 9 points to look at in the inventory process. And it's not asking me in those 9 points what kind of sex I was having. Like if it was a sheep, gay, whatever it is, S&M or whatever you're into. It's asking me what kind of a person I was having it. And the most beautiful thing, and I'm going to end with this part because it's very important for everything, I think. Whatever our ideas turn out, we must be willing to grow towards it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided we do not bring about still more harm in doing so. In other words, we treat sex we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answers will come. I always tell people, look at the ifs in books. Next time you look and read your big book, look at the ifs. The right answers will come if we want it. Do you want sobriety? Do you want another way of living? It's available. I don't care what age you are, who you are. It's neat. And I very appreciate having the honor to do this stuff. And it's not my favorite thing. I love it one and one. But it's obvious. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you another way of living, to be in tune with the planet and yourself and your spirit. Having a spirit, my spirit's alive today. There's so much energy among you young people here. You're my fountain of youth. It's the neatest thing to be around here. I've been enjoying myself the time here. So thanks for letting me run my mouth.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Our next presenter is from Sedona. He will be sharing on chapters 5 and 6, or re-emphasizing, I guess. Help me welcome Bart.
Hi, my name is Bart, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I want to thank the two presenters before me, and I was praying before I came in here, how am I going to cover steps 3 through 11 in 20 minutes? And my God always answers my prayers. Thank you, God. That's how God works. And I also want to thank, more importantly, you guys for sticking it out so far through the big book. I came in, my sober date is June 12, 1995. I came into AA in 1987. And from 87 to 95, if I saw a room that said, "The big book comes alive," I would have found any other meeting to go to. So, and what keeps me sober is the opportunity to share the passion for this program with people. So you sticking this out is awesome. I'll put a little bit of a piece of my opinion in there, and I try not to share my opinions, but it's also from some experience. You know, it's heartwarming to sit in a room next door and hear about never had a legal drink. That touches my heart, and I probably would really love to be in there. From 87 to 95, that's where I would be, and that's why I couldn't stay sober. What I needed to hear was, how am I going to guarantee that I will never have a drink again, even though I never had a legal drink? And that's what we're talking about today, because that's what this big book talks about. To bring the big book alive is absolutely impossible unless you do one thing: incorporate it into your life and live it. You know, we can't do it justice. You know, that's like you asking me, you know, me trying to explain to you what a rose smells like. Everybody in this room, I guarantee it, knows what a rose smells like. Well, tell me. There's no way that that would come to life, no matter how hard you try to explain it. And it's the same thing with this book. So, being that we're kind of way off of the format of whatever, a speaker last night talked about, you know, not thumping right into the solution before we know what the problem is. And I'm a big believer in that, because I came into AA in 1987 because I wanted my life to be manageable. You know, that's all I wanted. I just wanted to manage my life. My life was horrible, and I just wanted to get some manageability in it. And I couldn't stay, so I stayed sober for quite some time, but I couldn't have good sobriety, and then eventually I would start relapsing a little at a time, and then I would go out on a mad tear. What I needed to know was what alcoholism really was, because otherwise I wasn't really going to be willing to do anything about my alcoholism. And there is a solution, going back a little bit. It really covers a lot about, you know, the doctor's opinion was covered real well, and you know, we have this over the weekend, and we have this physical allergy to alcohol. Once we pick up a drink, we can't stop drinking. And that's really easy to accept, because I'm blaming an outside entity. I'm blaming a liquid. You know, once I put that liquid in my body, I can't stop drinking it. And there's a solution on page 23. It says, this point would be academic and pointless if we never took the first drink. Therefore, the problem centers in our minds rather than our body. That's really difficult. We don't talk about that too much in AA. I'm the problem. My mind is the problem. I can't not pick up a drink. You know, in the same chapter, it talks about we walk into the Circle K for a loaf of bread, and all of a sudden, suddenly the thought crosses our mind that a cold one is a good idea, and we pick that up suddenly, out of nowhere. You know, that's really scary. Alcoholism is not a pretty picture. You know, there is nothing that we can do about it. And the last meeting next door, the doctors talked about that really good. And I was really grateful that the doctors covered so much about that there's nothing that really the doctors can do. We can't take a pill to fix it. We can't think it through. Even the best psychiatrist can't fix it. You know, we could just be on an airplane 30,000 feet up, and the stewardess walks by with that cart and says, "Do you want a drink?" And suddenly the thought crosses my mind that we're all the way up there, and the flight is a little bumpy. Yeah, a drink will be a good idea. And then the physical kicks in. So with that information and a lot more information in a lot of pages in this book, we absolutely realize that we're powerless over alcohol even before we pick it up. That's scary. But based on that power, and I'm somebody who also walked in who didn't believe in a God. And I didn't believe in anything. If I couldn't see it, touch it, feel it, hear it, it ain't so. So I would have fought till you gave up that there is no God. When I was convinced that I was 100% powerless over alcohol, even before I picked it up, out of desperation, I became willing to see power. And that's where the rest of these steps came in. That was my second step, was I believed that some of you believed, you know? And that was enough to start with. My third step, our third step, is the most important decision that any human being can make on this planet. To turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand them. And that is, for me, that I don't. Today, 15 years later, I still don't understand God. I know God is everything. I can't. But I developed what this book talks about, that vital sixth sense. You know? I was looking for God with my first five senses, and I couldn't find it, so therefore it wasn't. But by living this way of life, I developed, and we developed, this vital sixth sense. And so turning all my thoughts and all my actions, or making a decision to do that, out of desperation, out of knowing that I'm totally powerless over alcohol, to make a decision to, when I'm thinking, bring this God that I don't understand into it. When I'm taking an action, bring this God that I don't understand into it. To take away my difficulties, so victory over them will make my life better. It's not what it says. So victory over them can bear witness to you. God's power, God's love, and God's way of life. That's the only reason that when I was called to come down here tonight to speak, you know, I just came back from my honeymoon. I was away for 2 weeks in Hawaii. I had a drive from Phoenix to back to Sedona. And I'm looking really forward to Thursday coming back down to Tucson to hear some great music. I didn't want to come back again today for that. But there was a calling to bear witness of God's power, of what God can do for the alcoholic. And that's why I'm here tonight, based on that third step decision. And I became willing to do that. God, I don't understand God at all. I don't know what this God is. But if God really does remove my alcoholism, then I'm absolutely willing to show other people. That's what the third step was about. And based on that, I was handed a pen and I wrote that inventory. You know, I began to see and really see that when I took away the first two columns, you know, that I didn't have to look at who I was angry at and why I was angry. What I needed to look at was that third column, my spiritual malady, that I'm walking around, you know, with all of this stuff we write in the third column as my own spiritual malady, and take responsibility for that in the fourth column. Then I was free. You know, some of us have horrible things done to us, and that's not why we drink, but it is why we keep resentments, and some of those things we may never forget, but we can look at it, like the book says, from an entirely different angle. You know, them like ourselves are sick too. God, show me how it can be helpful. You know, but the most important piece and the hardest thing to do is putting out of our minds what others had done, and just look at how am I affected today? How am I affected today? And take spiritual responsibility for that. It's difficult. Probably when you're young, it may be a little more difficult, because when I was full of piss and vinegar, the last thing I wanted to do was say, you know, they're all horrible. I mean, my life consisted of, you know, I have a passion for sharing a message at young people's conventions, because from 14, 15 years old on, I was institutionalized, locked up. You know, I got to speak this morning. Jeff Fett invited me to speak at the juvenile corrections facility. Touched my heart. You know, how grateful those people should be that AA comes in to carry the message to them. Because when I was locked up in those places, AA never walked in to carry the message to us. You know, we really aware today that, you know, alcoholism doesn't wait until you're 30, 40 years old to hit you. You know, it hit me when I was like 10 years old. Anyway, so we do all these inventories, you know, the sex inventory, the fear inventory, the resentment inventory. And what do we do with it? The book asks us to share it with another person or persons. And that's a very humbling step, and it's a very important step. And it's a double-sided step. I stay sober today because I'm available, again, based on the third step decision, to hear people's fifth steps. We look for a closed-mouthed person. Well, that's a double-edged sword, you know, or a dull sword, I guess, because if you share your inventory with me, and the joke around everywhere is, and it just happened the other day again, you're probably really safe sharing your inventory with me for two important reasons. One, because I know that my life depends on keeping your confidence, because if I share what you shared with me and that gets out in AA, I'm going to die alone, because nobody's going to trust me to use me to share their fifth step. The other reason is because I did a lot of drugs and alcohol, and I guarantee you I won't remember what you told me anyway. I did an inventory the other day. I sponsor a few guys in Prescott and at a sober house, and I was away for 2 weeks, and I came back, and one of the guys that I'm sponsoring there, he had said, can we do my fifth step? And I said, absolutely. And I said, you know, how long is it going to take? And he said, just a few minutes. And I said, why? And he said, because right before you left, we did the resentments and we did the fears, but I didn't know I had to write a sex inventory. I didn't hear you tell me about that, or I forgot, so you told me to do that. I totally forgot that we even did the first two. So, and he got a little insulted, but I said, buddy, just don't worry about it. It just means that your shit is safe with me, that's all. So, but to let somebody know and to practice that and let God know, although he knows anyway, but to share that with God and another human being is an extremely humbling step. And the book says that if we don't do it, the most important reason that we do it is because if we don't do it, we're going to drink again. And that's a fact. Out of bitter experience, that's a fact. That if we hang on to the worst items in trade, or whatever the word is, in stock and trade, they give us all of those formats of the resentments, the fears, the sex conduct, but it also says we told someone our whole life story. You know, that we don't need to write down our whole life story. But if you did some horrible shit, you need to let somebody know. You know, find that closed mouth person. My suggestion always is the one thing that you're going to do a fifth step and you pray first and you explain to the person that's about to hear it why you're doing it, and then you tell them that one thing that you're really not sure if you're going to tell them, and get that out of the way. Because then you'll have a much more freeing experience. And I still do that today. 15 years later, I still write inventory, and I'll still walk into a fifth step and wonder, am I really going to admit that I'm such an asshole after 15 years of sobriety? You know, get that one out of the way first. Okay, spend the hour. And I've heard some extremely, you know, Tara has the most awesome story of spending the hour, that, you know, 59 and a half minutes isn't enough, but sometimes it's that other half a minute that all of a sudden you get what you needed. So spend the hour reviewing, you know, step one, step two, step three, step four, and then step five. You know, was I honest? You know, did I let everything out? My experience with six and seven has gotten more difficult today than it was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, when I did my first inventory and I went home and I looked at step six, I was willing to have God remove everything because I still had that desperation. And I believe that's why the book says, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Because I was fresh off of my relapse when I started doing this. I was sponsoring people before 3 months sober when I came back in 95. And I know that that's the only reason I sit here today and I continue to stay active. We beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start, because my sixth step, there was nothing I wasn't willing to let go of because I was so desperate. Nothing was worse than going back to drinking or drugging. Nothing. So God could have it all. So my seventh step was really easy. God, take all of me, good and bad. Use me. Get rid of all this crap that blocks me, because I don't ever want to drink again. You know, 15 years removed from it. You know, the book says we can't remember the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. Well, if you can't remember a week or a month ago, you know how much harder it is 15 years later? And as you get older, it gets even harder, I guess. You know, so sometimes we're not quite as willing as we get sober longer, because, you know, it's hard to revisit the first step as easily as it is the first time through it. So we beg of you to be fearless and thorough right from the very start. The eighth step, some of it is from our inventory, and some of it is just from that whole life story. You know, some people write notes why they're doing it, some sponsors write notes. You know, there's people that we've harmed that we had absolutely no resentment, you know. There's people that I just plain out hurt, robbed, beat up, whatever, caused horrible harms to, And they were just victims, you know. I had no resentment against them, but I definitely owed amends to them. So we make that list. And then we become willing to make amends to all of them. And my experience was I went right to all the schools that I had been to. And, you know, I looked for everybody that I had harmed. And I was willing. In the beginning, it's easy. You're desperate. You just don't ever want to drink again. There were people that couldn't be found. It's a lot more difficult now with the internet. You could almost find anybody. But, you know, in my circumstances, there were people who, women who had gotten married, changed their name. It's hard to find them. My first wife, who was a detox nurse, I thought that was one of my cures, you know, marry a detox nurse. Didn't work. I was online. She made it very clear, stay out of her life the day we signed the divorce papers. So I knew that amends was stay out of her life, and I knew that even before I got sober. But she had a son, and he caught a lot of the abuse. And how am I going to make amends to this guy? And how am I going to find this guy? And I was online in the bank one day, and this 6'7" guy standing in front of me, and he turns around, and he had a pigeon chest that was real obvious of who it was. You know, his face didn't change. He definitely had that pigeon chest, and my heart dropped. And I prayed to God, and I got to make an amends, and that was when God put in my life. And I was working on boilers, cleaning boilers in New York, and I was in a room, you know, and the customer says to me, "You look familiar." And right away, it's like, uh-oh. And then it's, maybe there's amends here, but we'll talk. And the guy asked me if I'd gone to a particular school, and I did. And he was the woodshop teacher who I had abused horribly. And I got to make an amends. And he wasn't even on the list, because, you know, there's some that you harm, you don't even know it. I was in an AA meeting sharing my story. And after I shared my story, the meeting got open to sharing. And the first person to raise his hand and share talked about that he had used to work for my dad. And when he would have to work for my dad would have to go to bail me out of jail or bail me out of some situation, it was really difficult to work for him because he was angry and miserable and a horrible boss. Never even met this guy. With tornadoes roaring through the lives of others, and I needed to make an amends. You know, so it is a lifelong process, but the ones that you're aware of, and I could say today that all my amends that I'm currently aware of, I've made. Does that mean that they're all done? No. I'm sure there's plenty that I've rode through that I haven't met yet. 10-step is my favorite promise. 10-step says that besides the directions of pausing throughout the day, pause throughout the day, ask ourselves if we're bringing God into this, watch for fear, watch for, you know, things that we're acting out on, the promise of that the problem will be removed without any effort on our part, it just comes. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. If I had asked, what's the miracle, and somebody said that that's the miracle of it, that the problem will be removed without any effort on our part, I absolutely think I would have said, what the hell do I got to do? We should be reading that at every meeting. What a promise. Because I woke up hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mornings and ask for the problem to be removed. I can't drink today. I can't go out and get high today. I can't no matter what. I don't want to. And I did it anyway. Trying. The fact that the problem is removed without any effort on our part, what a miracle. You know? 11-step, waking up in the morning, bringing God into your day. The 11-step. Sitting at the edge of the bed or getting on your... However you do it. You know, Tara, my wife, she rolls out of bed like this. You know, people say, roll out of bed and hit your knees. Well, she literally rolls out of bed and hits her knees. I sit at the edge of the bed, you know. I stand, I review my day, I plan my day. You know, my 10 and 11 is very similar. It doesn't matter. It's personal to you. You know, there'll be technicians that'll tell you you must do it this way. You know, in the beginning, that's how I did it, and then I got comfortable with however I do it. And will that change tomorrow or soon? Possibly. You never know. But all I could say is, you know, that this design for living that I got to talk to about tonight is absolutely amazing. You know, the fact that the 10th step comes through is absolutely amazing. And I want to thank you again for sitting in this room and listening to this stuff tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, Bart. Our final presenter is from Tucson. He will be sharing on chapter 7 through the end of chapter 11. Help me welcome Jeff.
Hey everybody, I'm Jeff. I'm an alcoholic. My anticipation for doing this, given the time and right before the big speaker meeting, was that I'd be talking to a couple of two, three people, and that's okay. I'm comfortable talking to as many as need to be here, but thank you guys for being patient. I know most people's attention span lasts about an hour, so I don't know that I'll use the whole 20 minutes or not. We'll see what happens. I know a little bit of what I wanted to talk about. And I'm gonna mess with this a little bit. So just the moniker, The Big Book Comes Alive to Me, is talking about the practical application of this in my life. And this is like a flesh and bones kind of thing. Like, what does this thing look like in motion, you know, in actual being lived out in human life? And I'll probably share a little bit from an experiential point of view with this. One of my beliefs about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's right, it comes into play right, maybe on the first or second page of the doctor's opinion, says we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as altruistic plane. I look at that, my interpretation of that is we work out our solution in steps 11 and 12. So you hang around enough meetings, you might think it's all about the four step, man. You know, that's kind of the big topic. And yeah, that's true, but there's eight more steps after that, you know. And I think my solution, I think the fourth step is part of a process that prepares me for a life of serving other human beings. Ultimately, my solution, the answer to extreme selfishness, is extreme selflessness. So how does the spirituality, we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as altruistic plane. So what technically am I supposed to be praying about in step 11? And I'm going to bring you to... I'll just tell you what it says. On page 164 it says, ask each day in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who's still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. So I think what I'm supposed to be praying about is how I can best help you. As a result of being concerned with helping you, God is then able to come and enter my life and help me in ways. When I'm looking around trying to help myself, trying to grab the things that I think I need to make me feel better, it's like trying to grab a greased pig. Everything I want and hope for gets away from me and slides away from me, and I end up disappointed. When I just simply pay attention to bringing people into my life and trying to enter into their life and trying to fit myself to meet their needs, everything I want gets taken care of. I was riding around with a newcomer the other day, and I was telling him about some promises that happened in my life. When I was brand new, and I was like on fire, and I remember my mom telling me one day in her car, she says, like, everything you touch turns to gold, and it's just amazing. And it really didn't have anything to do with me, and it was like I was working so hard at just really trying to help people that my karma was tuned so high that it, like, everything went right. You know, I was at a weekend. It's not like you didn't get a flat tire. It's like when you did, it happened right in front of the gas station, like those kind of problems. But everything was just clicking with me, especially in early sobriety. Not so much this past year. I'm the little kid on this panel. I only got 8 years, and everyone here is 10 or 20 plus. So let me tell you, just go right into working with others. This book, Chapter 7, Working with Others, says very little about sponsorship in the way we think about it. It talks a lot about the 12-step call. How would you approach someone? Do you meet them through his family? Do you meet them at the hospital? It's the timing. When do you show them the book? When do you not? Do you make? So it talks a lot about the 12-step call and very little about sponsorship, and that's an art form that's been elaborated upon as we go through the years. But I love this first paragraph. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity as from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they're very ill. Danny last night elaborated on that beautifully, about trying to go to the meetings and get help as opposed to trying to go to the meetings and help somebody. And so I need to place myself in a position as quickly as possible to be helpful to other people, I think is the whole point of this thing. Let me say this. A guy whose lineage I was in, a man named Don P. from Denver, Colorado, used to say, don't take this thing too seriously. It's only life and death. And I believe that's true, but I also believe this. People get so caught up in, will I say the right things? Will I do the right things? Am I fit to be a sponsor? And what I would say to you is, this is on-the-job training. The only way you start to do it is by doing it. And you don't have to be a therapist. And here's the part I like. And you can let yourself off the hook anytime you want by saying, I don't have the answer to that question. If I'm in, I've sponsored a guy who was a grandfather. I don't have kids, let alone grandkids. I've sponsored different kinds of people that come to me with specific problems, and I'll say, I don't know what to tell you at all about that, but I know someone that does. So I'm not meant to be a therapist. I'm not meant to be a guru. I'm not meant to have all the answers. I'm here to share one thing and mostly one thing, the solution to alcoholism as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12th step is crystal clear. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of... Wait. I just lost it. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of this... These steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. There's only one message to carry. I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. My sponsor was sharing from the podium, and he was saying he asked a group of corrections guys in the Northeast up by Boston, all these guys 20 plus years sober going into prisons and stuff, and one day he asked them, what's the message we're carrying? And people came back with all kinds of stuff. 90 and 90, easy does it, just don't drink no matter what, if your ass falls off, put it in a bag, take it to a meeting. Where does it say that in the Big Book? Doesn't. We have one message to carry, that my light, that I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of working these steps. That's the message I carry. I feel like I know this work pretty well. And again, it's not from having it taught to me. When someone's teaching me the work, I believe it's very cognitive and mental. When I turn around and teach it to someone else, I believe it becomes intuitive and from the heart. And oftentimes, the thing I like about it, if people in here have sponsored a lot of people, you find yourself saying stuff that you didn't know you knew until you just said it, and you're like, wow, I'm going to write that down. I'm going to write that in my book, dude. That was like, I was right on that deal, you know? That happens to me a lot. I like that. That's the power of this thing. Is, like I said, it's on-the-job training. You learn as you go. You get sharper as you go. You begin to recognize patterns of problems in different people, and I get a little bit, it's like I'm sharpening my tools. I get a little bit sharper each time I go. So I got really overwhelmed a few years ago. I'll kind of get into some practice the principles and all my affairs. I love this thing so much that I go overboard with it. My little joke is I'm one sponsee away from a failed marriage, if you know what I mean. Like, she's like, dude, where's we gonna happen tonight? It's not, honestly, it happened tonight. And a few years back, I was sponsoring, I don't know how many guys, but it was too many guys, and I had four or five commitments, and I'm the chairman of two different things, one thing like this, and another work, and I'm doing a lot, right? I don't say that to be ego, and I was really in a lot of pain, and really busy, and really kind of beat up, and I've learned some balance since then, but I called my sponsor up, and he kind of put it back in perspective, and I'm like, complain, work too hard, can't get any sleep, blah, 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 whatever. It's all the same stuff. And he says, what did you think was going to happen when you turn your life over in the third step? You think God was going to have you sitting on your ass and watching TV? This ain't that kind of a deal. There's a lot of work to be done, and human life's at stake. And you've got a message to carry. This is important, you know? So, now that being said, I have learned, I don't take on any more sponsees than I can. You know why? Because I'm not effective in their life. If I bring you into the fold, but I don't have time to take your calls, evidently that's not a good fit, right? If if I bring you into the fold and as a result my wife is suffering in the process, or some, or my job or something is suffering in the process, evidently that's not a good fit. We do kind of have to have a little bit of balance. So back to what the book says, and this is a little, I'm going to see if I can put this together right. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics, that's working with others, and practice these principles in all our affairs, which is the family afterward, to wives, to employers. The interesting angle on that chapter, though, it's not really telling me how to bring the principles into my work and to my wife. It's about presenting, it's about how to bring other people into my life so they can practice the principles also. Two wives literally means, here, you might want to read this, so when I'm screwing up, you have a better idea on how to deal with me, I guess. Or a friend of mine, Leo, who absolutely believed in practical application of the Big Book, you know, he was new and he was on fire and he was doing what we do. I did this too. I told my family, I'm like, yeah, you might want to read that. You need to know what I'm about, you know? And they're like, yeah, we know, thanks, right? But this guy gave a copy to his boss, like when he was new and all like that. Yeah, you need to read this. It's got a chapter in here to you. And that same boss, 5 years later, pulled him in, was holding his book, and he was like, dude's got a drinking problem. He kind of says, like, maybe I should fire him the second or third go-around that he messes up. What do you think? The practical application of this thing is wonderful. So it's got a chapter for me, how to practice this, and then it's got some chapters to others to present to them how I can bring them into spiritual way of living as well. You know, Bill Wilson really believed, we believe this way of living has its advantages for all, you know, and it was kind of Al-Anon that came out of that. And let me talk a little bit about living by spiritual principles, and then maybe I'll stop with that. When I get clear on what those are and how to apply them in my life, my calls to my sponsor are far less frequent, because I don't often wonder, like, oh my God, what do I do? Okay, have you tried being honest? Oh, well, no. You know what I mean? It makes my life, no matter what the problem is, if you live by a set of rigid principles as applied anywhere, your solutions are always fairly simple. You know what I mean? I'll give you an example. I went through the work again this summer, and this is my interpretation of the third step, and we're going to get a little bit off of it. I always had this idea, like, anything I want is self-will. Oh, you want the silver Corvette? Self-will. You know, oh, you want to date the blonde girlfriend? More self-will. How do you know? What if the vision was God-inspired in the first place, and it's not what I want that's self-will, but how I go about trying to get it that self-will. So I go to the car dealership. I lie about how long I've been employed. I lie about how much money I make. I misrepresent my trade-in as, you know, I don't mention that the transmission start. Whatever, right? Or I go to date the girl, and if you're me, I lied about the fact that I have hepatitis. Lie about how long I've been sober. Lie about, you know, I spin it and misrepresent myself in a way, and maybe that's the self-will, right? And maybe God's will for me is, why don't you be completely honest and live by principles, and whatever's on the other side of that experience is my will for you. Will you get hired or will you get fired? Who knows? Why don't you try being honest and find out? And that, to me, is living by principles and practicing these in my affairs. It's really, the glue that holds my entire life together is this work. How much time? 5 minutes? You'll never be lonely if you make this a way of life. If you're ever lonely again, it's definitely by choice, because you'll have so many people in your life that there's not really a lot of time for that. If you're going into a facility, maybe a treatment facility or a psych ward or corrections, it's great for depression. Scott Lee says that. It works great on depression. But you'll never be lonely again unless it's by choice. Because this, and I love, That was my grand sponsee that was tearing up reading a vision for you last night. Makes me tear up thinking about him tearing up. Like, how weird is that? And it said, there's a line in there, it tells you the gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, it's great, it's a substitute, you know, there's a substitute for the life you're giving up. And it says, well, where and how am I to find these people? And it says, you haven't met them yet, because they're still drunk. You're going to go out there and you're going to start this, and you're going to build this. You're going to grow up the fellowship around you that you want. What a cool thing that is, huh? There's this cat, and he ends his pitch by saying, maybe me helping you isn't about me getting help as a result of helping you. And maybe me helping you isn't about you getting help as a result of me helping you. Maybe me helping you is just us about us both being willing to be links in the chain. Maybe it's about alcoholic number three that neither of us have even met yet, because he's still out there drinking. I talked to one of my sponsors. I'm going to close by saying this. And y'all have the right to do it, and I have the right, I guess, to say something about it or not. I'm not going to get on my soapbox, but yeah, I am. It hurts my heart when I hear How It Works read, and I hear people make a big joke out of it and just massacre it and throw little weird sexual jabs and stuff in. The rest of the stuff I'm good with. And I asked a sponsee of mine, how do we change that? Because I believe, yeah, we absolutely insist on enjoying life, and I believe young people should be fun, but I believe the literature has its place, and how do I know someone doesn't need to hear that, and all they can hear is the joke that we're making when How It Works is being read? And I said, how do we change that? And he says, one person at a time. Just, you know, through sponsorship, telling people that's not what we do, man. We don't turn the literature into a joke, you know. And that being said, I did 10-step, and like, everyone has the freedom to do and be what they want to do and be. And I have the freedom to, one person at a time, politely tell them, this is how I feel about that. I love this literature. This book saved my life. And I'm a seemingly hopeless candidate for this. And this is definitely, come alive for me. That's it. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Jeff. Here to read a vision for you, help me welcome Stephanie.
It's fine. I'll just bet. Stephanie Alcoholic. Where is it?
Oh.
Never mind. I got it. All right, this is a vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Amen.